about the last time I taught it. I think it's probably been 13 years or something like that since I've taught it. And I've only taught it one time in my entire life. So bear with me. I'll do the best I can. I feel a little bit out of my element. So that's the first thing I want to say. And then the second thing that I want to say is that this isn't going to be is a life of Christ study. And I think it's easy for us when we look at a gospel specifically to turn it into that, right? We try to fit the events that we're talking about in this specific gospel within the framework of the other gospel's timeline. We don't have time to do that. We got plenty to talk about in John itself. Will there be occasions where we do that? Yeah, there will be. But we're not going to continually do that. Like I said, we just don't have time. John gives us plenty by itself. So this is a study of the Gospel of John, period. And speaking of that, let's see, do we have this ready or no? Yeah, there it is, at least for me. So I guess everybody can turn around. No. So speaking of that, one of the questions that we have is, why is John so different? Because when you read the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then you read John, you're in a different world. And I mean, think about how the Gospels begin. Matthew begins with a genealogy. Mark begins somewhat abruptly with the preaching of John the Baptist. Luke begins with an introduction which orients it within Greco-Roman historiographical texts. And then you get to John, and you read, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Whoa. It's a different world. Okay, so why is it so different? Because if you've read the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it doesn't take long to figure out, now wait a minute, a lot of these events are very similar. A lot of the texts themselves are very similar. Some of them are verbatim. They're the same almost. For example, feeding of the 5,000 in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. If you compare those three texts, almost identical, very minor changes. So you say, well, they're different, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when comparison to each other. That's true, but not like this. In John, we meet a Jesus that we don't get much of in the synoptics. I think there are some reasons for that, but that automatically commands our attention. So there are stylistic differences. Okay, what do we mean by that? Well, that means the text itself is different. The chronology is different. The actual language is different. When you learn New Testament Greek, probably the first gospel you read is the Gospel of John. Why? Well, the syntax is easier than something like Matthew or Mark, and certainly Luke. So it's different just on a linguistic level, okay? But I would also say style has to do with his presentation of the information. For example, in the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, the word that's typically used for miracles is not the same word that John uses typically. John uses the word that is translated sign, which automatically tells us, even in terms of the miracles, there's something else going on. For example, when John presents the miracle of the man who was born blind, right, in John 9, it's not just about Jesus healing the blind man, which is impressive, of course. There's something more to it. And you keep reading John 9, you figure out what that is, and it's not that difficult. Jesus can heal people who are blind physically. He can also heal people who are blind spiritually. That's what John 9 is about. That's easy. Some of the other ones aren't so easy. All right, this is what I think, and at the end of the study, if you disagree with this, that's fine. Let me know. That's okay. But I think John, in some instances, is purposefully ambiguous. I think he wants us to struggle with this. What does this mean? What does this sign signify? Right? Because I think that's why he uses that word. It's kind of like, what is this, a podium, right? Isn't that the appropriate term? This podium. Well, the word podium by itself doesn't mean anything. It only means it's something when it has a referent, which is this object. Okay, what am I saying? Well, think about if you only knew something like Polish, right? Completely unrelated to English. Well, is the word podium going to mean anything to you? No, it doesn't mean anything, right? It only means something with this referent. I wouldn't go quite so far to say that's how the miracles in John work, because if we went that far, we might say, well, these miracles aren't historically valid. They didn't. In other words, they didn't happen. That's not the point. The point is they did happen, but they also point to something else. And maybe that something else, especially for readers of the text like ourselves, is more important. I mean, think about it. Again, back to that example in John 9. This is going to sound callous. I mean, but how much do we really care that that guy who was born blind was healed? I mean, it's nice, good for him, right? He died a long time ago. None of us never met him. We didn't even know his name, right? So, okay, yeah, it matters, but what does it matter specifically to me? That's what I'm saying. It does mean something to us specifically now, all right? So that's stylistic, and we could say much more, and we will say much more later on. What about theological? That word, for whatever reason, is one that we often don't like to mention. What is it? Does anybody know what it means? The word theology. Anybody know what it means? That's a good start. Let's try it again. Does anybody know what theology is? Thank you, sir. Yeah, really, that's what it means. The study of God or the study about God. Nothing wrong with it, nothing scary about it. So the question then is, what does John tell us about God? And what he tells us about God and God's, of course, relationship with Jesus is unique. Now, for a long time, scholars thought, well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they don't really say anything about the deity of Jesus. Well, no, that's incorrect. I think there are several passages that do. But when you compare it to John, it's not as explicit. Okay, now you might say we're not necessarily talking about theology, we're talking about Christology. If theology means the study of God, then what does Christology mean? The study of Christ. What does this tell us about Christ specifically? Okay, but we don't have to go into all that. All right, so again, what I want to point out is John is different. By the way, this painting that'd be to your right. Probably all you can tell from it is a lot's going on, and that's right. But it's supposed to be the wedding at Cana. And this is an Italian work. There's a lot going on, but I think it demonstrates how powerful some of these stories are about the miraculous, right? Again, you can look that up. It's Veracy, I think, is the artist. Okay, so we could probably skip this discussion, right? We could. And so you might be thinking, all right, well, if we can, why don't we? Well, because I don't want to, all right? That's why. And I get to make those decisions. I think this is worth discussing, because I remember a few years ago when I really started studying the texts of the Bible seriously, and I started reading scholarship on these texts, I had no idea some of these things were even an issue, like this, specifically with reference to the Gospel of John. All right, the question now is, well, is John anonymous? Because Matthew, Mark, and Luke, strictly speaking, are anonymous. Does anybody have a problem with that? Good, because if you did, you'd be wrong. Now, what I mean by that is, let me be very clear. What I mean by that is, you can't look at Matthew, for example, and see at the very end or at the very beginning, this here gospel is written by Matthew. You can't find that. It's not there. So strictly speaking, they're anonymous. Now, then the question becomes, well, how do they get these names attached to them? It's a good question. Well, that's apparently an early tradition associated these gospels with these individuals. Now, somebody might think, oh, okay, why can't we just go find the original of Matthew, the original text, and see what the title is at the top? Because we don't have it. We have copies of copies of copies. And those earliest copies, all of them have the titles of the gospel. So that's how we associate them with their various authors. Now, early Christian tradition is another way to do this, and we'll talk about that with reference to John. But now, back to that question. All right, we got that out of the way about Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And by the way, again, am I saying that Matthew, Mark, and Luke didn't really write that? No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, strictly speaking, from the text that we have, they're anonymous. That's all I'm saying. Well, what about John? Well, no. John isn't like that. John, again, is different. So look at the end of the gospel, chapter 21, 24 to 25. This is a statement of authorship. This is the disciple who's testifying to these things and has written them. And we know that his testimony is true. There are also many other things that Jesus did. If every one of them were written down, I suppose the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Before we get to what the specific thing we're talking about, I mean, 25 just blows my mind. And it's enticing. And frankly, I'm a little bit aggravated with verse 25, okay? Because what that says is what we have is not everything. And I would say that's true not just for the Gospels, it's true for Acts. We just finished studying Acts in one of the back classrooms. And we had different teachers, and various teachers brought that point up. It's a good point. And when I teach Acts, sometimes I will say, well, that's some of the Acts of some of the apostles. Right? There's a lot more going on. Well, this text tells us there's a lot more going on. There are a lot more things that Jesus did, too, that we don't have. We have a precious few things he did. Anyway, 24 is what we want to look at more specifically here. This disciple is referred to as the beloved disciple. He is not named in the Gospel of John. Now, that's not the same thing as saying it's anonymous, because there is an authorship claim. It just doesn't say specifically who it is other than the beloved disciple. All right, well, who is that? That's the question that we have to try to answer. And there have been several proposals. We don't have time to go into all of them. So I very subjectively chose the ones that I think are most interesting. The first one I think is really interesting because there are certain scholars who think that a community produced this text. Sometimes it's referred to as the Johannine community. That's basically a community around John or traditions about John. So it's called Johannine. So then, therefore, the beloved disciple would be symbolic. I want to be a beloved disciple, right? I want to be a disciple beloved by Jesus, as I'm sure everybody in here does as well. So that has a certain appeal. But the question then becomes, do we have precedent for that in the New Testament? Somebody might say, well, yeah, Theophilus, right? Theophilus, the dedicatee of Luke and Acts, is symbolic, according to some people. Theophilus' name means friend of God or lover of God. Again, that's something I want to be, right? Well, by the way, I don't think it's symbolic in Luke and Acts. That's just my thinking. I think it's a real guy. I think he's maybe the one who is supporting Luke financially in this endeavor, so he dedicates to it. It's very common practice. But anyway, so let's put that to the side. Let's say, well, all right, maybe not Theophilus. But is there any precedent elsewhere in the New Testament? And then we look at something like 3 John, which is written to the elect lady. Now, this is, of course, really good evidence because this is within the Johannine corpus. Is the elect lady metaphorical? I think probably so. I would say I'm much more confident about that possibility than I am about Luke, Acts, and Theophilus. So there's precedent. And there may be precedent even in the Johannine corpus of texts, right? But I don't really buy it here. It's possible, but I don't know. Another interesting possibility that's been offered is Thomas. And Thomas is interesting because think about then that scene, which is, you might say, is one of the climactic scenes of the entire gospel, is when Thomas confronts the resurrected Jesus. And he says, it's not enough just to see. I got to feel, are you real? Right? And of course, that's where we get the whole doubting Thomas notion. But if he wrote the gospel and he includes that detail in there, I mean, think about how powerful that is. Okay? And there are some ingenious arguments which connect Thomas to the gospel as the author. But I think when it comes down to it, we need to seriously consider the traditional view, and that is John the Apostle. Are there any of these arguments better than John the Apostle? Not really. Because with John the Apostle, we have internal evidence. Because that beloved disciple has, number one, got to be one of the 12. All right, John certainly meets that criterion. Secondly, it's got to be someone who's very close to Jesus. Maybe the inner circle. Well, James is mentioned. Peter is mentioned. John is not mentioned by name. I think that's pretty good internal evidence. But we'll also look at external evidence. But when we look at external evidence, things get a bit messy, as they usually do. And that's when we've got this other individual, John the Elder. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but I don't want to go into it a whole lot because it's frustrating, frankly. All right, well, let's look at some external evidence. Irenaeus, who's an early Christian writer in the second century, toward the late part of the second century, he wrote a book called Against Heresies. Not exactly the most fun read, in my opinion, but it is interesting historically because he tells us about a lot of different groups that, as you might imagine, were in opposition in some way to the early Christian movement in the second century. His main opponent, I would say, throughout the text, are the Gnostics. Now, very quickly, we'll talk about Gnosticism later because it is part of the history of scholarship of the Gospel of John, Gnosticism. The Gnostics, I think, really took off in the second century. And it's not like you got a group of people, you say, oh yeah, there are the Gnostics over there. There's the Gnostic church. We can go visit it if we want. No, there are groups of Gnostics all over the place, and they didn't agree with each other. I know that's surprising. Right, you got a group of people, and they don't agree with each other about something. Right, you get two people, you're probably going to have a disagreement eventually. Right. Well, anyway, that's how it was with the Gnostics too. So he's talking about a specific kind of Gnostics that are referred to as the Valentinians. Now, this is interesting because he says the Valentinians teach that John, the disciple of the Lord, proceeds in teaching from the beginning from God and the Word, stating, "Thusly, in the beginning was the Word." There's a quotation of John 1:1, and an attribution of authorship. But what's significant is, these are the opponents of Christianity. And you know what you might expect Irenaeus to do? To turn around and say, but we all know John the Apostle didn't write it. He doesn't refute it at all. Any chance John has to refute the opponents, specifically the Gnostics, he's going to take it. And he doesn't say anything here. So I think that's pretty good external evidence that at least in the second century, this gospel was associated with the Apostle John. Justin Martyr's writing a little bit earlier, and his take is a little different, and it's not as helpful. He's talking about baptism. And he says, then they are brought by us where there is water, the people who want to be baptized. They're regenerated just like we are in the name of God, the Father, the Lord of the universe, and our Savior Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit. They then receive the washing with water. For Christ also said, unless you be born again, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. There's a quotation again from the Gospel of John. It's from John 4. He doesn't say John wrote it. He doesn't say it's a quotation from the Gospel. The way that Justin Martyr quotes from the Gospels is a little bit difficult to deal with, because it's not like he's got the text open in front of him and he's like, oh yeah, okay. No, it's more complicated than that. But it's still, this is the earliest quotation we have from the Gospel of John, mid-second century. All right. So, again, I think that's some external evidence, because then the question would be, why would he be quoting from a gospel when he knew it wasn't written by an apostle? Maybe that's not such a great argument because of the Gospel of Luke, right? It's still, I think, some evidence. This is where things get aggravating. And we're not going to spend a lot of time with this. There's this guy named Papias. We only have him preserved fragmentarily. He is a hugely important witness in the early second century for the origins of the Gospels. He talks about the origins of Matthew. What he says doesn't really make sense with our Gospel of Matthew. We have to do some mental gymnastics to make it work. Well, here he says something about John that I don't really get. And what makes it worse is Eusebius, it's preserved in Eusebius, who's another church father, and his interpretation, I think, makes it even more confusing. So he's talking about, I questioned him in regard to the words of the elders, what Andrew or what Peter said or what was said by Philip or Thomas or James or by John or Matthew or by any of the other disciples of the Lord. All right, so we're good. We know what he's talking about. But then he says, and what things Aristion and the presbyter John, the disciples of the Lord, say. What is he doing here? Is he talking about another John? Or is he talking about the same John and he just mentions him twice? Well, Eusebius says, it's worth observing here that the name John is twice enumerated by him. The first one he mentions in connection with Peter, James, and Matthew, the rest of the apostles, clearly meaning the evangelist, the author of the Gospel of John, is what he's saying. That's why he refers to him as the evangelist. But the other John he mentions after an interval, places him among the others, putting Aristion before him, and he distinctly calls him a presbyter. He goes on to say that there are two Johns, both of their burial places are in Ephesus. I find that difficult to believe. I mean, John, Yohanan was a pretty common name, but I don't know. There's something going on here. I'll say this, though. I think Eusebius' interpretation is maybe correct. So I bring all this up, and now I'm kind of questioning whether I should have even brought this up, but too late. I think it's worth bringing up because there are some scholars who think John the Elder wrote the Gospel, not John the Apostle. But some people think Revelation was written by John the Elder. This was written by John the Apostle. I mean, it's a mess. It really is. Thank you, Papias, and thank you, Eusebius, for making this so confusing. I mean, the easiest thing to do would be just to ignore them and just say they don't know what they're talking about. But should we do that? I mean, these are early witnesses, right? So perhaps we shouldn't dismiss them so clearly. All right, so all that to say, I think, why did I go through this exercise? Well, I want us to see that we can still affirm traditional views about things like authorship here. But rather than just say, well, that's the way I've always been taught, I don't know any different, we can reason through it. And by the way, we're not dealing in many cases with scholars who want to somehow discredit the New Testament, right? We bring up New Testament scholarship, we say, oh, well, there's a bunch of scholars, they want to do away with the authenticity of the New Testament. Are some of them that way? Yeah, there are some that's their motivation. I don't know about you, but I'm not very good at ascertaining motivation. I try to not do that, in fact, because I'm not very good at it. In fact, sometimes I'll do things, and afterwards I'm thinking, why did I do that? I don't even know my motivation in some context, right? How much less will I know about other people's? Sometimes some scholars will just come right out and tell us their motivation. That's helpful, but not all the time. So again, some scholars take this evidence seriously like this. So, again, I think, to conclude this section, that we can, I think we can view traditional authorship, be pretty confident. I don't really see any other arguments that are as strong as that one. All right, well, let's get more into the text itself. This is maybe an oversimplification, because when you look at all the Gospels, what are they about? Well, they're about what Jesus said, and what about Jesus, and they're about what Jesus did. Well, you got the same dichotomy in the Gospel of John. But in the Gospel of John, the discourses, again, here's this word, the discourses are different, the works are different. All right, Jesus speaks differently in John. So in the synoptic gospels, you frequently have the situation where Jesus is challenged, or there's some claim made about Jesus, or he makes it, he's challenged, he responds, and then there's some sort of what's referred to as a pronouncement statement. Something about Jesus is concluded. It's typically how it happens. Or Jesus is the last one to speak, right? That's kind of how things go. That's not the case in John. In John, you've got a challenge. You've got a claim, you've got a challenge. And when Jesus responds, the response is typically much more sustained, much longer. Okay? And also, much of it is couched in controversy. Jesus is constantly having to defend himself, sometimes in different ways in the Gospel of John than he does elsewhere. And the question that keeps coming up in John, and frankly in the other Gospels too, just who is Jesus? And a lot of times Jesus in the discourses will go on to say who he is, and that's where we get, of course, the famous statements, "I am." And then he says several things in the Gospel of John, as we'll see, of course. He openly declares who he is. I would say in the synoptics, it's more of a mystery. It's more left open to the reader. Who is this Jesus? What am I going to do with him? Whereas in the Gospel of John, he confronts us as readers in a different way. He says, this is who I am. Now what? Now what? Right? So, that question is there. Now, all this conversation takes place, and also the miracles as well, take place within an honor-shame society in the Greco-Roman world. Right? Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that in public discourse in particular, you have interactions. It's almost like a transaction. But the transaction is not monetary. It's honor and shame. You meet someone on the road. You have an interaction with them. One person's embarrassed, the other person isn't. They did something maybe to cause the embarrassment. One person's honor goes up, the other person's honor goes down, or shame increases, right? That's how it works. I think it's interesting to think about, well, do we have that in our culture? And I'll say, yeah, we do. What's interesting about our culture is it doesn't just take place in public anymore, right? It takes place in social media. Honor, there is honor and shame being exchanged on social media, right? Maybe that's obviously not maybe. It's obviously not how it works here, okay? So this is from Molina and Neary, who have a really interesting book about Luke-Acts and honor and shame, but it's certainly applicable to any Greco-Roman or Mediterranean text like the one we're talking about in John. And here are the elements here. And I bring this up because when we look at what Jesus is saying and doing in public, this is, I think, what's happening a lot of times. Now, every time we don't have the same elements, right? But a lot of times we do. We have a claim made about Jesus. Maybe Jesus himself makes it. Maybe the disciples make it. An opponent comes up and says, wait a minute. That's not right. There's the challenge. Then we have riposte, which means response. Maybe it's Jesus. Usually it's Jesus. Maybe it's the disciples. But then we have the public verdict. The public verdict, that's when honor or shame is decided. Never has a man spoken like this, right? That is a public verdict about Jesus. Now, what's really interesting, I think it's significant in the Gospel of John. It's also significant in the Gospel of Luke and in the others, but particularly those two. And that's Jesus' interactions with people who are not his equals in society. Classic example is his interaction with the Samaritan woman, right? They're not equals in society. I'm sorry. I mean, this is not in the Greco-Roman society. And yet, Jesus somehow increases his honor in this interaction with someone else, and she's not really put to shame, is she? We'll talk about that in this context when we get there. It's fascinating. The other way to look at it is, if this is supposed to be between equals, what about Jesus' conversations with the Jewish leaders? What about his conversation with Nicodemus? Nicodemus is a Pharisee. Are they equals? In that conversation, do you get the impression they're equals? No, you get the impression Jesus is superior to Nicodemus. And yet again, Nicodemus really isn't put to shame. So it's worth remembering this as we go forward. All right, so that's the discourse element of this. But then we have, as I've already said, we have signs in the Gospel of John. We have these miracle stories. Again, remember, like the man born blind, it's not just about Jesus healing this man, which again is a significantly impressive action. It's about healing spiritual blindness too. What's the purpose of the miracles in the Gospel of John? Now, a lot of times we'll answer this question regardless of what book we're talking about in the New Testament. We say, well, the miracles attest to the validity of the message. And I would say that works most of the time. That's a really good explanation. It truly is. But is that what's being discussed here? Or is that how it's portrayed in the Gospel of John? Well, let's think more about miracles in the Greco-Roman world. Was Jesus the only person who performed miracles in the Greco-Roman world, at least the records we have? Is Jesus the only person who it is claimed performed miracles in the Greco-Roman world? Anybody answer that question? No. We got the apostles, right? If we want to expand it and say in the ancient world, people are performing miracles in the Old Testament, right? But let's go back to the New Testament. Jesus, the apostles, they're performing miracles, right? Anybody that's not Jesus or the apostles perform miracles in the New Testament? Anybody know? Yeah. Exactly. Good answer. Simon the sorcerer. Is he performing miracles or is he just tricking everybody? Well, the text says he's performing these miracles. It doesn't say, in parentheses, he's tricking people. It's kind of like the Egyptian magicians, right? When Moses goes before Pharaoh and he performs these miracles and the magicians try to do it, and they're able to do some of them. I've heard people say, well, they weren't really doing them, okay? Well, to me, it looks like they fooled the author of Exodus, right? Because he doesn't say that. The New Testament authors don't say that. And then when we expand it and we say, all right, extra biblical evidence, Greco-Roman text. It's really important. Is that to say that was never the point? No. But most of the time, that's only part of the equation. So that's worth remembering in the Gospel of John as well. Any questions about that? Like I said, I think that's really important. Because I've been in Bible classes and I've heard sermons preached which make the Jews sound like idiots because they didn't believe. Or they're just so wicked they couldn't believe he's performing his miracles. They don't believe he's God. What a bunch of idiots. No. It's more complicated than that. And I think saying about that group of people is a mistake as well. We'll get to that eventually too, right? All right. So this is very well known. The first 12 chapters of the Gospel of John. Notice I begin in verse 19. That's because we have the prologue, which is the first 18 verses. That prologue is incredible. And I'm going to already tell you, we'll start that on Wednesday, and I'm going to do a disservice to it. Because I feel like the prologue of John's Gospel is so far above my capabilities that I have no chance. I'm going to try, but ultimately I'm going to fail because it's just so lofty, right? Anyway, so I begin in verse 19, go through chapter 12. You got the water to wine miracle at Cana. Yeah, I know. Cana. No, it's Cana. That's how I'm going to say it. If you don't like it, sorry. Then we have the healing of an official's son. Not the same healing that we have in the synoptics. We've got the healing of the paralytic. Again, we see that in the synoptics. Not the same. Feeding of the 5,000, walking on water. Now think about this. All these miracles, only two of them are in the synoptic tradition. I find that pretty interesting. And that raises questions. What did John know about the synoptics? A lot of discussion about that. We don't have to go into that, fortunately. We got the healing of the blind man, and then we have the raising of Lazarus. And then we start this second section, the last section, chapters 13 to 21. Jesus washes the disciples' feet. Now think about how that occurs. Some people, by the way, refer to the first 12 chapters as the book of signs. But think about how disjointed it is at first. You got this Jesus, this very powerful individual, who's turning water to wine, but he's also raising people from the dead. And in the very next section, at the very beginning of it, he's washing the feet of the disciples. In that one dynamic, you see who Jesus is. Yes, he's powerful. But he's also humble enough to wash people's feet, right? Amazing. You also have the paraclete, right? There's this question of Jesus preparing his disciples for his death. What are we going to do? One answer Jesus gives them, well, you'll have some help. That's the paraclete. He refers to himself as the vine and the branches. Then he goes on to talk about his relationship more generally with the world. And then we have in chapter 17 what's referred to as the high priestly prayer. And then, of course, you have the passion and resurrection. By the way, passion just means his suffering. This is a word that sort of gets mixed up in English because passion means something that, you know, you're really excited about. That's not what that means. It means suffering here, right? And then, of course, we have resurrection, including maybe the culmination of the resurrection appearances. I say maybe, it's debatable. And that experience with Thomas that's depicted here. And I think this painting does a really good job of demonstrating, look how close Thomas is to Jesus' side. He's got it. I mean, it's not enough just, you know, to do this. He wants to see it. That's how much evidence he needs, right? I think that captures that beautifully. All right. Final thing today. And again, this is something I probably could have left out. But this is sometimes, I would be curious if anyone's heard this before. But this is something that I've heard quite a bit. Is John anti-Jewish? Now, the reason this comes up is because John refers to the Jesus' opponents as the Jews most often, without any qualification. You know, not like the wicked leaders of the Jews or the unbelieving Jews. He just says the Jews. So a superficial reading of this might be, well, is this anti-Semitic? That's an important topic, obviously, given what's happened in the last few decades. And of course, I'm more sensitive to this. As some of you know, I went to a Jewish school, so this is something that's probably in my mind, may not be anybody else's, but that's why. Now, somebody might respond to this and they say, well, it's written by a Jew. How is it going to be anti-Semitic? Well, even if those who say it's anti-Semitic would argue that, or admit that, they would say, yes, but the readers are Gentiles. Were some of the readers Gentiles? Probably. We are, right? But I'm talking about the original readers. But we're readers. And I would also say some people have read the Gospel of John and they have interpreted it that way, and they're Gentiles. So this is a serious situation. Here's my response. Not just mine, of course. I think this is the typical response, and I think it works. The Jews are representative. That's all. They're representative. When he uses that term, it's representative of the opponents of Jesus. But I also think it's representative of their own opponents. Some scholars think that the readers, the original readers of John, were going through this conflict that they had with the Jews. So the Jews are the opponents of Jesus. They're also our opponents as the first readers of the text, if we put ourselves in that position. So Jesus dealt with them in this way. This is how we deal with them. So it's not a condemnation of all Jewish people forever. It's about our opponents, not ours now, as original readers, our opponents, but also the opponents of Jesus. I think that's probably how it works. All right. Next time, prologue. Can't wait. See you.